Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, host of the In Context War Report, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe, and our producer, Gus Cantavero. In the War Report, we report on recent developments in wars around the world. We show how these developments fit into the global geopolitical picture and how they affect U.S. national security. In today's edition of the War Report, we're going to focus on the important role that Islam plays in military conflicts today, conflicts between the United States and Muslim nations, as well as conflicts within Muslim nations. But first, Marchand, I'd like your thoughts on two recent stories concerning the United States' principal rivals, Russia and China. The Russians recently reached an agreement with Cuba to reopen the Russian intelligence center in Cuba. What is the significance of this development?
This intelligence center, which is located outside Havana, it is the largest listening post in Latin America, and indeed one of the largest in the world. At its height, it was built during the Cold War. At its height, it housed 3,000 Soviet intelligence agents. It's a signet post, which means signal intelligence. So it intercepts communications going in and out of the United States, surrounded by radar dishes and whatnot. It was closed in 2001 by Vladimir Putin as part of the warming relations with the United States. Oddly enough, Russia had some of its warmest relations during the Bush administration years. And I think a lot of this was because there was kind of a tacit understanding that you have your sphere, we have ours, and yeah, we'll push each other through proxies, but we won't push into Eastern Europe and you won't push into Latin America kind of understanding. In recent years, and particularly most recently with the situation that's been developing in Ukraine, Russia has felt that the United States and by extension NATO is pushing back into their sphere of influence. The gloves have come off in terms of Russia pushing back into ours. Putin on July 16th made a trip to Havana where he met with Raul Castro. During that trip, he agreed to forgive 90% of Cuba's debt. Cuba owes a tremendous amount of money to Russia, and this was actually reported in Russia Today. Russia basically said, you know what, 90% of your debt is forgiven, wow, and we're going to bring back our military installation. And for the Cubans, this is great news, because Cuba's economy has been in tatters since the fall of the Soviet Union, because what kept the communist regime in Cuba alive and prospering was its massive influx of funds coming from the Soviet Union. When this ended, the only thing that kept the Castro family in power was fear of the United States and authoritarianism. But now Putin said, I'm forgiving your debt. I want to restore the military base. I'm going to pay you $350 million a year for it. And not to mention, this is going to bring back possibly 3,000 Russian soldiers, sailors, and Marines who are now going to spend money in Havana, you know, vacation in Havana. They're going to, so for the Cubans is a boon, for the United States, not so much, because this is the return of Russian troops to the country closest to the U.S. coast.
And of course, so, the United States, it's of course, Russia now has a base, a naval base in Venezuela as well.
Exactly. But this puts them just that much closer. Cuba, more than strategically important, in terms of intelligence resource, it is incredibly important. But it's more than anything, it is psychologically important. Because Venezuela, the U.S. can afford to ignore. The reports of the naval base in Venezuela, which any of our listeners can research, it was reported in Reuters, it was reported in the Associated Press. The U.S. media did virtually no coverage of it. Agence France-Presse did a great article on it, but it really hasn't been talked about since. And it's because it's in Venezuela, the U.S. can and the American people can afford to ignore it. But Cuba is something that the American people and the American government cannot afford to ignore. I mean, they can try. We do have a bit of an Orwellian media where we do like to not talk about the things that are truly frightening in the world. But the fact is that it is, from a propaganda standpoint, a huge victory for Russia.
I was just going to say, they're in spitting distance. I mean, we still have Guantanamo Bay open. We have the two biggest rivals in the planet occupying the same island.
And exactly. People anticipated then Raul Castro dies or resigns that the Cubans would then be vulnerable to more U.S. influence. But with the Russians there, that would seem less likely.
Oh, exactly. Russia will not allow the communist regime in Cuba to fall because it's not about them being communist. It's about them being pro-Russian. So when Raul Castro steps down, there'll be another puppet that will be put in power.
The United States government really missed a big opportunity. I mean, they've been enforcing these sanctions on Cuba for decades and decades now. We've had calls from like Ron Paul going back to the 90s saying it's time to end the embargo on Cuba and allow free trade and travel to try to help to lift the economy and open relations and improve the perception of the United States and the free market economy in Cuba. We've seen a little bit of motion towards free market in Cuba, where people are allowed to own a little bit of property and own some businesses if they are able to garner the favor. But for the most part, you still have really severe poverty outside of the main cities where the international tourists go. I think the United States really dropped the ball yet again with its international relations here. And how does a country become so bad at international relations?
There is a strong element of hypocrisy. I think after a while we get caught up in our own propaganda, because the whole reason ostensibly why we wouldn't do business with Cuba had to be, well, they were communists. But
right.
Let's face it, we opened up diplomatic relations with Vietnam, a communist regime that has killed Americans, that we fought a war against. We had diplomatic relations with them. And under Nixon, we opened up diplomatic relations with Nicolae Ceausescu's communist regime in Romania. And then not to mention, of course, we have diplomatic relations with the Chinese, who we like to pretend aren't communists,
right,
but they are the worst kind of communists. And we have not only diplomatic relations with them, but we owe them billions. But yet at the
right.
same time, we pretend that because Cuba's communist, we're not going to have diplomatic relations with them. We really did drop the ball, but we also did drop the ball at the end of the Cold War in Eastern Europe as well. Our chance to really pull Eastern Europe out of Russia's sphere of influence was by making them prosperous. And instead, we backed these despotic,
right.
corrupt regimes in places like Romania, Hungary. And I saw that in Egypt. President Obama would go and he'd hug Hosni Mubarak and shake his hand and kiss his wife's cheek and whatnot. I was there. And Hosni Mubarak was just as bad as Saddam, just as bad as Bashar yeah. al-Assad. The difference was he was our friend. If we truly believed in the principles of democracy, we would have supported the democratic process in Egypt. And now you can see that President Obama is trying desperately to get General el-Sisi, who's, by the way, a Russian puppet, but trying to get General el-Sisi onto the U.S. side by paying him money and whatnot.
Yeah.
But the fact is el-Sisi's a dictator. We're not really propagating democracy. We're just propagating our sphere of influence, you know?
Exactly.
We'll pay you more than the Russians will.
The Russians now have this, or again have this large military center, intelligence center in Cuba. Is it likely this is a precursor to some serious military hardware from the Russians?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We will never experience again something like the Cuban Missile Crisis. Because at the end of the day, no president is going to threaten to drop the bomb, just as no prime minister or premier of Russia or premier of China is going to threaten to drop the bomb. It's lunatic. Nobody will do it. However, would the Russians put bombers in Cuba? Absolutely. Put missiles to launch, ballistic missiles to launch EMPs over the United States? Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, what are we going to do? We'll threaten to nuke the Russians. They'll laugh. We won't do anything.
Is there a question that we might be able to, we might try to blockade Cuba again as we did before to prevent the Russians from bringing in supplies and weapons?
That's the thing. We may very well try to blockade the Cubans. We may very well, I mean, that could be the pretext in a wider conflict for us to militarily intervene or try to destabilize Cuba. I think the big thing we have to look at when we look at Cuba, it is, unlike Syria and unlike Ukraine, it is much closer to home, but the fact is it is an extension of the conflict that's going on with Russia. And it might reach that point where just the United States decides, well, our only choice is either be surrounded by the Russians and contained, or we bomb Cuba and bomb the Russians out. Or alternatively, we're going to provoke a war in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, to prevent this from happening. From a historical perspective, what we have to look at is that these are two massive superpowers, and we count China, which we're just about to get into, as a third, jostling for top dog. Invariably, unless one side decides to back down and rescind power to the other, you will have a major war.
The prospect of a war with Russia is something that we need to be concerned with. And of course, also we need to be concerned with the rise of China and the prospect of war with China. And that was the subject of an article in The Week by David Axe. David Axe argued that China could not defeat the United States in a military conflict
right.
in the Pacific. He claimed that the United States had such technological superiority, especially regarding subs, that our submarine technology would defeat any Chinese amphibious invasions of places like Taiwan. And he secondly argued that China's power has already peaked, and that if the United States could just hold China in place for 20 years, China by then would no longer represent a threat to U.S. interests in the Pacific. Marchand, what are your thoughts on Mr. Axe's arguments?
Yeah, we held the Soviet Union by and large at bay for the better part of 40 years. But the fact is, though, is that the threat of nuclear war really helped keep us all back. That threat doesn't exist, because one of the things the Cold War taught us is no one's going to drop the bomb. Nobody wants to be responsible for the annihilation of humanity. So that's not a deterrent.
What do you think of the argument that they have peaked, that China is sort of run to this as far as it can go?
He was saying that the largely male population is aging, and because they have had this one-child policy in place, they're no longer able to take care of their elderly. The population will be in such decline within 20 years because they will have such a burden of this huge amount of elderly people. Is that correct?
True. But the fact is that no country on the face of the earth is going to sit there and go, well, geez, our population's going to collapse. Let's just wait around 20 years for it to happen. No.
Right.
You tend to see when this sort of thing happens, if we look at Japan after the Meiji Restoration, as a prime example, countries, when they start to feel themselves hemmed in, when they're looking at domination by foreign powers, when they look at potential internal collapse, yes, if China doesn't do anything for the next 20 years, it has peaked. But if China decides, you know what, we have a 350 million man army, which, by the way, their army, if they call up their reserve and their security forces, they will have an army equal to our population, number one. But number two, no country is going to sit by and just watch itself internally implode. So if China were to, let's say, take over the Pacific, control the Philippines, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, all the oil and natural gas resources, then no, at that point they would have peaked. At that point, you're going to see the most powerful country on the planet. The fact is also, to get to what he was saying about our technological advantage, a lot of this has to do with a false sense of American superiority. We have not fought a superpower really since World War II. We haven't. Every other country we've fought since then has either been like North Korea, militarily inferior, Vietnam, militarily inferior, Iraq, military inferior, Grenada, Panama, Afghanistan. I mean, these are all countries which, not for nothing, if you hit them with World War II technology, they probably would have been at a loss, let alone, you know, stealth bombers. The fact is, none of this technology that we have has been tested against the latest in Chinese and Russian military technology. The other thing we fail to realize, since 1991, we showcase every piece of technology we have. And the Russians and the Chinese immediately began to revamp their arsenals. They said, wow, we really got to play catch up. We've fallen behind. Now, the United States, by comparison, while Russia and China were revamping their arsenal to meet the United States, we stagnated. The United States stagnated. We stopped investing in the same military hardware.
Well, we're taking a step backward because we've been fighting guerrillas out in the mountains of Afghanistan, and we've been tailoring our army to a command and control style using these digital satellite communications just to try to coordinate men on the ground, rather than creating countermeasures for stealth submarines or countermeasures to other stealth bombers.
Regarding the submarines, what do you think of Mr. Axe's claim that our submarines are so superior to the Chinese technology that the Chinese couldn't make
it? And Russian, though. He was counting the Russians as well.
Okay, that they couldn't land troops in Taiwan. What do you think of that?
When we look at submarines, let's look at the Russian Borei-class submarine. It is the latest and greatest in the Russian military arsenal. It is virtually silent. It is virtually stealth. It carries the Bulava missile, which, yes, we like to knock the Russians because it had some faults in the testing process. But because of the way the Russian arms industry works, the ballistic missile didn't work the first time. The Russian government said, okay, well, we're not paying you a dime till we get our finished product. On the other hand, you look at the F-35, which is our latest and greatest stealth fighter bomber. Billions of dollars, it's still not airborne. So we are in no position.
No, it's just been grounded again.
Exactly. But these stealth submarines also, and the Chinese have been sharing the technology with the Russians. The only difference is the Chinese don't talk about it as much as the Russians do. The fact is, Russian submarines have been spotted off the eastern coast of the United States. Chinese submarines have been spotted off the western coast of the United States. What does this mean? If we had the capability of keeping them off our coast because our submarines were so brilliant, then we would. But the fact is, all it takes is a one Russian submarine with 10 Bulava missiles to wipe out our entire infrastructure. Because whether EMP, conventional, or nuclear, or chemical, they can wipe out our entire, one could wipe out our entire infrastructure. And they're on our coast. The notion that we are so vastly superior.
Explain the Bulava missile, by the way.
It is the latest and greatest Russian ballistic missile. It contains, if memory serves, 12 warheads, independently guided, with their own countermeasures, and they're supposedly hardened against electronic interference. Now, the advantage is that if each submarine carries 10 of these missiles, now 10 times 12 being 120, that's 120 independently guided warheads from one submarine, meaning that if they were to launch a surgical strike right off our coast, we'd have zero warning, no ability to stop it, and they could hit our command and control systems, they could knock out our Minuteman ballistic missile systems, and this is all if they use conventional ordnance. It is a very sophisticated piece of hardware.
Well, Marshawn, if I could just interrupt for one moment here to remind our listeners that they're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. The In Context War Report is on every fourth Monday of the month at noon, from noon to 1 p.m., and we do an overview of the world's the wars around the world, and we take a look at the latest in the military technology, the geopolitical context in which these wars are fought, and in particular, how these wars affect the security of the United States. So, Marshawn, please go ahead.
I think one of the things that we need to look at when we look at this situation with Russia and China is if we, again, I'm not saying this to batter the U.S. or batter the U.S. military. Rather, I'm saying that if we as a nation don't wake up and realize that these threats are real, that they can get around our technology, that not only can they get around it, but they can negate it, then the sooner we realize that, the sooner we can develop countermeasures to protect ourselves. Again, another example, the Chinese developed the J-20, which is their latest and greatest stealth fighter bomber. Now, its capabilities, we're really not sure of. Why? Because they developed with us without us knowing about it. The Russians have developed a new stealth fighter bomber themselves, a new Su-25. With this stealth technology now, theirs are airborne. Our latest and greatest F-35 was grounded for so many reasons. Problems with the fuel tank, problems with the oxygen system, problems with the engines, problems with the guidance system. We still can't get our latest and greatest airborne. Then the F-22 has also been suffering severe setbacks as well. So you watch the movies, you watch the Bourne Identity, you think our intelligence services know when these guys are going to the toilet. But the fact is that their technology now has hit that point where we've stopped, we've stagnated, and a lot of this is due to corruption, and theirs has continued to go ahead, leaving us at a very grave disadvantage.
The F-35 has been kind of a political football in Congress recently because it is a perfect example of the military-industrial complex and its unstoppable march for profit. And it has nothing to do with defending American borders or even American interests. The way that these projects keep rolling along is because they source a piece of the pie from every congressional district of people who are on the Armed Services Committee. So when you ask them to vote against this project, they're basically taking the jobs away from 3,000 people in their district.
Sure.
How on earth are you going to get a project like the F-35 grounded permanently and defunded when you have all this bankroll tied to it with its tentacles in every single district in the country? There's something from every state in the country is making something for the F-35.
Well, and I think that's part of the problem is that because of this complex and virtually corrupt system, we're looking at a finished product that's not finished, that's in fact it was supposedly finished, but it's incredibly faulty.
It's garbage.
Probably won't see combat. It's garbage. If it does see combat, it'll be at the end of the war, like the German jet in 1945. Great job, guys. End of the war, too late. The Russians, when they develop a lot of their technology, it's modular. They updated their T-90 battle tank, which is the most modern Russian tank, and considered one of the best in the world next to the German Leopard. They decided they wanted to upgrade the turrets. Because it's modular, they simply screwed off the old turret, screwed on a new one, brand new tank. They do that with their aircraft. They do that with their ships, which is why we laugh at them because they don't replace them. But they don't replace them because they don't have to. Instead of scrapping a whole jet, they say, well, I can take out the computer system, put in a brand new one. The thing is great, you know, and it rolls back out into battle. They did the same thing with their BMP fighting vehicles. Now, we spent billions on these ridiculous MRAPs, which are great if you're fighting an insurgency.
What is an MRAP?
The MRAP is, it's designed specifically to carry troops and protect them from IEDs. Very effective, totally pointless in a conventional war because it's large and slow and not very well armed.
It's designed for a certain purpose, and that purpose is not going to help us in a battle with the Russians.
Which is precisely now why MRAPs are being scrapped and sold for scrap heap. They're being given away to police departments. A good example is the Los Lunas Police Department in New Mexico. Now, I challenge our listeners to find Los Lunas on the map. Los Lunas Police Department in New Mexico has an MRAP. And the reason is because the government doesn't know what to do with them. They're giving them away. The fact is, though, is that by comparison, the Russians decided they wanted to upgrade their BMP. Now, the BMP is an armored personnel carrier that they've used since the 50s, and they've used it for everything from conventional war to unconventional war. It is a great vehicle. Moreover, it had its faults, but every fault they found, because it's modular, they didn't have to scrap the whole vehicle. They just simply changed the part that was wrong, and they upgraded their BMP fleet recently, the turrets, by simply unscrewing them, screwing on a new one, unscrewing the old armor plating, screwing on thicker armor plating, and the fleet rolled back out as if, you know, without any massive expenditure.
Now, Marshall, we started this conversation focusing on technology, but what you're alluding to is the possibility of a land conflict. I can infer from the Mr. Axe's discussion of the week that as a part of an assumption of our Pacific policies that there will be no land war, that the United States' superior technology will stop the Chinese from landing and making any amphibious invasion. Therefore, there will be no land war. But suppose there were a land war. Suppose the Chinese were able to land in Japan or Taiwan.
Or Alaska.
Or Alaska.
What capability would the Chinese have to win a land war?
If you're looking at a land war, the Chinese have not only numbers, but they have the technology. Now, numbers by themselves are not the only deciding factor. Although, again, I do like to point out to our listeners, in World War II, Germany had the best technology, bar none. Best tanks, best planes, best trained army. And they were ultimately defeated by two armies full of conscripts. I mean, when you look at the United States Army, the soldiers were mildly trained and they were conscripts. The Russian Army were by and large unarmed peasants, but they had decent technology and large numbers, and that overwhelmed the Germans. If you look at, by that logic, too, the situation with China, the Chinese technology is good. It's on par with the United States. In a lot of ways, I think it's superior, but I'll leave that argument for later. The fact is that if the Chinese were to go out onto the battlefield in, let's say, Alaska, for example, they could field 100 tanks for every one of ours. I do not care how great the Abrams is. It is a nice tank, but it'll run out of ammunition eventually. Moreover, they can replenish their troops, their personnel, and their vehicles, their jets, and their ships a lot faster than we can. Our military infrastructure ceased to exist. During World War II, we had an amazing military infrastructure. We don't have one now. Most of the parts that go into all of our computer systems, all of our guidance systems for our aircraft, our armored vehicles and whatnot, all that stuff is manufactured overseas. So if we were to have a war with China, we could not replenish our armaments because we don't have the capability of manufacturing most of this stuff. In the event of a land war, China not only has the numbers, they have the manufacturing superiority and the technological superiority.
And how many troops could we get to, say, Taiwan? We would have problems getting troops there as well, right?
We would have significant problems, especially because you can't simply hop troops on a plane and fly them over, especially if the risk of the Chinese Air Force knocking our planes out of the sky. And the fact is that a war in Taiwan would only last a few hours, because feasibly for us to mobilize 100,000 troops would take weeks. We couldn't mobilize the Chinese. One thing is the Chinese and the Russians have both proved in their recent snap drills. The Chinese and the Russians both have the capability of mobilizing minimum 120,000 troops in less than an hour. 120,000 troops ready to go, tanks ready to roll, jets ready to move in less than a couple of hours. On the other hand, for us to mobilize, that would take several weeks. Taiwan would have fallen before our troops in Japan would be able to mobilize, because of its proximity to China.
Is there kind of
wait a minute. We do have the Philippines, Korea, and Japan all within vicinity.
That's true, but the immediate reaction would be not to launch an offensive strike, because if we did, our limited force in Japan and the Philippines would now be vulnerable to a Chinese strike. Once we attempted to intervene in the Philippines, I mean, I'm sorry, intervene in Taiwan, it would draw our forces away from Japan. It would draw them away from the Philippines. Most likely, in all fairness, what would take on is paralysis and disbelief. Usually when there's a major attack like this, there's an initial period of paralysis. That paralysis only has to last for a day even, and that would be enough time for the Chinese to take Taiwan. Additionally, though, the Chinese would calculate. They may very well calculate that a war with Taiwan would mean war with the United States, and they might as well end up launching a multi-pronged strike, one at Japan, one at Taiwan, and one at the Philippines. They have the personnel to do it. That's not the issue. Certainly, that's what the Japanese did. When the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor, they attacked into Malaysia, the Philippines, and Burma. I mean, if the Japanese could do it, the Chinese could do it.
Would the Chinese really be willing to sacrifice the economical interest, the stake in the game? That means they would basically be sacrificing or foregoing all the debt that America owes towards the China and all of the production that they create over there, all the electronics and all the goods that we buy.
Sure, the trade would end.
The trade would end immediately, within a day. So they would have truckloads.
And that's
and
an argument, Gus, you often hear is the Chinese won't go to war with the United States.
Because they need us.
Because they need us economically. Right.
For China, it would be an all-or-nothing gamble, because if by chance they did lose the war, they would be economically ruined.
Well, to gain Taiwan and lose your trading partner, what do you gain?
It wouldn't be just a strike for Taiwan. It would be a strike across the Pacific. It would be a strike to militarily smash the United States, force us into a humiliating treaty whereby we'd have to repay massive reparations.
Oh,
blame us for the war. It doesn't matter. Let's take Germany in 1918 as the example. No Allied troops took Berlin. It wasn't like World War II where we fought our way to Berlin. We forced Germany to the negotiating table. We broke them economically. And then we forced them to pay these humiliating reparations without ever actually having captured Berlin itself. The Chinese very well could do that if, let's say, they smashed us militarily in the Pacific, they took over the Philippines, Taiwan, Japan, and they told us, listen, all of your electronics are made here. We hold all your debt. Your country's bankrupt. And certainly if at the same time, Russia and China, let's not forget, have a mutual defense treaty. If they were to, let's say, at the same time, Russia were to move into the Ukraine or were to strike the U.S. from the east, if you lob a few ballistic missiles into the U.S., on top of militarily really giving us a bloody nose overseas, you may very well force a militarily unprepared United States, an economically unprepared United States, and a crisis unprepared population to capitulate. This stuff happens. It just hasn't happened to us yet. But if we continue down this confrontational path with Russia and China, if we refuse to invest in our military and invest in our national defense and accept that these dangers are real, that the Chinese and Russians really do want to hurt us. If we refuse to accept this, we really risk the potential of to be not only defeated, but to lose territory.
Now, Marcin, I'd like to move on to the role of Islam in the global wars. But before we do, I'd like to remind listeners that they are listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm your host, and I'm joined here by Marcin McDermott Rowe, In Context War Report's military affairs commentator, and Gus Cantavero, our producer. We're on the fourth Monday of the month in WPKN, from noon to 1 p.m., and this show will be archived at our website, incontextreport.com, as well as on WPKN.org. And today's show, we started out by talking about the significance of Russia's reestablishment of a major intelligence center in Cuba, and what that means for United States national security in the region, and how it relates to the global war between Russia and the United States. And then we moved on to a discussion of the military status of China in the Pacific, its military strength relative to the United States with respect to such things as submarine technology, as well as conventional arms, the prospect of a land war and what that would mean for the United States in the Pacific. But now I'd like to move on. We're going to move on to a discussion of Islam. Since the end of the Cold War, the United States has been constantly involved in military combat in the Muslim world in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Libya, Yemen, Somalia, and I'd add Syria, too, since we support an insurgency there. The region's not only suffered at the hands of Westerners, but it's also suffered from self-inflicted wounds as religious and sectarian groups engage in all sorts of violence. Most notably, we've recently witnessed the brutal conquest of large parts of Iraq by the Islamic Army of Iraq and Syria. So given the crucial role that Islam plays in these external and internal conflicts, today we're going to ask some basic questions. What are the sects within Islam? What's their connection with the ongoing fighting? How does Islamic sectarianism relate to U.S. policy? And what does the future hold for the Muslim world? Marchand, let's start with Sunnis and Shias. Most of our listeners are familiar with these two groups. Could you talk about the origins of the Sunnis and Shias and what the beliefs are of these groups and why they're antagonistic to each other?
The fundamental difference between the Sunni and the Shia is not theological, rather it's political. Prophet Muhammad died, and there was the issue of succession. Who's going to lead after him becomes the great question. The Sunnis believe that Abu Bakr, who was a companion of the Prophet Muhammad, should be the caliph, the leader of the Muslims. The Shia, on the other hand, believed that Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, should be the leader of the Muslims. Now, Ali ibn Abi Talib was the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad. And so the Shia said, well, he is family, so he should lead because nobody would know the Prophet Muhammad better than his own family. And the Sunnis said, no, we believe Abu Bakr, who was his best friend, should lead. Ali becomes the caliph, and then he dies. After he dies, you have a power struggle now within Islam. There was a little bit of a struggle when Ali finally became caliph, but he was patient and waited, became caliph, and then dies. He was murdered. Now, when he dies, the issue of succession then, now Islam has spread significantly, one has to note, from its initial birth in Saudi Arabia to now it is spread across the Middle East at this stage. And it's spread into Persia, it's spread into Egypt, it's spread up to the gates of Byzantium. So it's much larger now, but with size grows political entities. And so a man by the name of Muawiyah decides, you know what? I want to be the new caliph. He decides to wage a war against the one that Imam Ali has ordained as his successor, who is Imam Hussein. Hussein is supposed to be the new caliph. Muawiyah and then later Yazid. Yazid says, no. He's not going to be the caliph. I'm going to be the caliph. And that's when you have the epic battle in Karbala. Now, realistically speaking, the Muslim world should have looked at what Yazid did, and regardless of whether you're Sunni or Shia, condemned it. And historically, Muslims, Sunni or Shia, condemned it, because what Yazid did is he massacred Imam Hussein and his family at Karbala, which is why to the Shia it's a very holy site. As I say, Imam Hussein was the son of Imam Ali. And now Imam Hussein was a direct blood relative of the Prophet Muhammad, which is where we get the idea in Shia Islam that the Shia tend to look more towards the family of the Prophet, because Imam Ali's wife was Bibi Fatima, who was the daughter of the Prophet Muhammad. So we're getting into some complicated genealogy here. In essence, Hussein is murdered, and the anti-Shia families, really there wasn't Shia and Sunni quite yet, but it was the anti-Hussein entities, which were Yazid and his people, take over the Muslim world. So they say, we are Sunnis, which are Ahlul Sunnah, followers of the Sunnah, the guidance of the Prophet Muhammad. That's what it's supposed to mean. But in reality, these people were not following the guidance of the Prophet Muhammad. They were following the leadership of a man who just wanted power for himself. And that is when you see the divergence in Islam. That is when you see the real divergence between Sunni and Shia. Because the Shia went off, and they were the ones who would not submit to Yazid or his caliphate. And they went off, and they went off into Persia largely, which is why Persia is predominantly Shia. Right. And that is where you see the divide. And that's why I say it's political, not theological. Because, yes, there is some difference in terms of the way they pray. The Sunnis, by and large, with some exceptions, cross their arms. The Shia pray with their arms open. They do their prayers a little differently. Theologically, though, it's the belief in one God, the belief in the same prophets. There is no real theological difference. The difference is that the man who proclaimed himself the leader of the Sunnis was the one who won, and the man who proclaimed himself the leader of the Shia was the one who was killed.
So what are they fighting about today?
That's the only difference.
Why are they so antagonistic today?
Again, it's political. Because
it's tribal.
Fundamentally, it's tribal, exactly. It's political, it's tribal. Because the fact is that really you have these people in ISIS who are saying, oh, we're Wahhabis, and Wahhabis are followers of Ibn Abdul Wahhab, who was a Puritan, who said, you know, we are going to return Islam to its purest form, which by that he meant not its truest form, but it was, they were going to bring it back to the Middle Ages, which is not a principle.
And the Wahhabis
are
part of the Sunnis, and they are they evolved in relatively recently, right, in the 18th century.
Exactly, and they arrived at political prominence with the establishment of Saudi Arabia, because the Wahhabis backed the House of Saud in their takeover of Saudi Arabia. When we look at the Wahhabism, Wahhabism really was remote. Because also the idea that Islam should return to the Middle Ages was never a principle for Sunnis or Shias. I mean, if we look at the Baghdad Khilafah, the Abbasids, or we look at the Ottomans, or we look at the Safavids in Persia, you see a tremendous amount of education, a tremendous amount of investment in science. These were men of learning. These were men of technology. These were men of science. They were not primitive. These were people who developed brain surgery. In the Abbasid Caliphate, they were using music as a treatment for psychological ailments. So these were men of the modern era. Whereas on the other hand, though, the Wahhabis were men of the tribes. They were the men of the Bedouins. And the problem is, though, is Wahhabism is a very useful tool, because unlike the traditional Sunni Islam, the Sunni Islam of the Abbasids and the Ottomans, and unlike the Shia Islam of the Safavids, what you see with the Wahhabis is isolation. It's no television, no education for anyone, no freedom of speech, no freedom of expression. It is an authoritarian system, the same as communism is.
So the people we're seeing these days committing all these atrocities, the beheadings, the grave desecrations, the killings of Christians, the killings of Jews, the killings of anybody who crosses them wrong, these are largely or entirely Wahhabis?
Entirely or by and large Wahhabis. There are some people who call themselves Hanafis or Shafis. These are different schools of thought within Sunni Islam. But the fact is that they are not true followers of Islam, because everything they're doing contradicts the fundamentals of Islam.
I've personally had conversations where people do not understand the divergence from true Islam and what these Wahhabis are doing and why they're wrong, because most of the people that I speak to have this idea that all of Islam preaches that anyone who's not Islamic is a heretic and needs to be killed. Can you explain that and why these Wahhabis are different?
Absolutely. A lot of people, what they do is they take verses in the Quran out of context, and they say there is a verse in the Quran that says where you see an unbeliever, you are to kill him. However, when you look at the whole surah, which is the whole chapter, it is talking about on the battlefield, and the only people you're supposed to fight on the battlefield are unbelievers. Well, who are unbelievers? An unbeliever is anyone who wages a war against a believer in one context, because a believer is a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim, anybody who believes in monotheism is a follower of the book, is a believer, number one. And number two, if anyone wages, even if they call themselves a Muslim, if they wage a war against innocent, unprotected people, they cease to be Muslims. They are now unbelievers. So that's what that verse is referring to, though often taken out of context. The Quran also says, fight them until persecution is no more and religion is for God. But if they stop, let there be no more war, for God never loves the starter of war, meaning waging any kind of aggressive war is a crime against God. The other thing is harming innocents. The first commandment of the Prophet Muhammad before the Battle of Badr, which was the first battle in Islamic history, he said, you shall not harm women, you shall not harm children, you shall not harm the man who works in the field, you shall not cut down trees. Basically, it was the first rules of engagement, which said, you shall not harm innocents, period.
Right.
And then, of course, there's the whole principle that Jews and Christians are protected. And in fact, Muslims have a duty to protect Jews and Christians, protect any religious minority, because as it says, I believe it is in the second chapter of the Quran, which Muslims believe is the direct word of God, there is no compulsion in religion, meaning no Muslim can make any other man or woman believe anything other than what they want to
voluntarily believe. But these are all contrary to the Wahhabi beliefs.
And that's what I'm saying. These are all the fundamental principles of Islam. These are all, in the Quran, verifiable principles. However, the Wahhabis completely contradict this. They murder women and children. They use children as suicide bombers. They oppress women. They murder Christians. They murder Jews. They murder other Muslims who don't agree with them, Sunnis or Shia. So these people are not representative of Islam. The problem is these people have been empowered largely by the United States and our NATO allies, because what the United States is, we funded Wahhabis. Well, we funded Saudi Arabia, and we allowed them to propagate the Wahhabi ideology because they were giving us a deal on oil. We supported Wahhabis in Afghanistan because they were anti-Soviet. We supported Wahhabis.
Talk about Afghanistan. I'm sorry. Go ahead and talk about Afghanistan and the Taliban and how that relates to this sect of Islam.
The Taliban was born out of the Wahhabi movement that came out of Saudi Arabia, because we supported the Saudi fighters and the Arab fighters that were coming in to Afghanistan to fight the Soviets, and through them the Taliban was born, and they propagated Wahhabism in Afghanistan, which never existed prior.
And this is the 1980s, against the Soviet, right?
Exactly. I talked to Afghans, many of whom were older, who said there never was Wahhabism until the Saudis showed up. The other thing that's worth mentioning, though, is that just the same as we sponsored Wahhabi-based Mujahideen in Afghanistan, instead of sponsoring moderate elements, we sponsored Wahhabis. Instead of going in after the Soviet Union fell and supporting the secular government or the moderate Islamic elements, we instead allowed the Taliban to sweep to power and in some ways enabled them, because we had armed their allies. Certainly Saudi Arabia, who we were arming, was directly arming the Taliban. But also, if we look at more recent history,
yes,
look at Syria, look at Libya. We directly armed the Islamic Fighting Group, which is an al-Qaeda Wahhabi entity. We directly funded and armed the al-Nusra Front, which is an al-Qaeda Wahhabi entity. So we were directly involved in the funding and spread of Wahhabism.
And of course, the Islamic Fighting Group was used to overthrow Gaddafi, who had allied himself with Russia.
And then they took American armaments and they airlifted them into Syria, and they joined with ISIS.
They airlifted the Libyan Islamist fighters, right?
The Al-Nusra guys.
And we reported that, I think, 4 years ago, when this supposed Syrian uprising started, that in fact, as it was reported in the Debka, the intelligence newsletter of the Israelis, that Islamist fighters were being brought in from Libya and inserted into Syria via Turkey through the help of U.S. surrogates, Qatar and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and everybody's saying, these are the guys who perpetrated 9/11. You know, these are the guys with the same ideology and the same belief that we have, the United States government has been making an enemy for the last 10 years. And here we are giving them money, giving them weapons, certainly, and giving them satellite information with military advisors on the ground. Like, what the heck is this supposed to mean? How am I supposed to comprehend this information, this topsy-turvy world that they're trying to show us? They're just confusing the heck out of everybody, saying these are the bad guys. No, wait, now they're good guys. Now they're bad guys. Now they're good guys. Like, we don't understand what the heck's
Syria,
going on.
Syria,
it's like cholesterol, you know? You have good cholesterol, bad cholesterol. You have good al-Qaeda, bad al-Qaeda. Right. It's the same thing.
It all depends on how you're using them. Clearly, it just comes down to who is convenient at the time. And it just goes to show that, again, the United States government talks out of both sides of its mouths and uses what's politically expedient at the time and what's convenient, because basically they're lazy. They're narcissistic, they're egotistical, and they really don't have a strategy. They just want what they want at that moment, like a child grabbing a shiny toy.
In addition to using the Wahhabi groups like the Islamic Fighting Group in Libya, like al-Nusra in Syria, we also exploit the differences between the Shia and the Sunnis. Could you talk a little about Iraq? What is the makeup of Iraq in terms of Shia and Sunni, and how have we taken advantage of those differences?
Iraq is predominantly Shia. It has a 20-25% Sunni minority. Traditionally, the Sunnis and the Shia lived alongside each other up until the rise of the Ba'ath Party, which, it's worth noting, was enabled by the United States in an effort to overthrow Abdul Karim Qasim, who was a pro-Soviet leader in Iraq. Now, the Ba'athists came to power with the help of the CIA. Again, this is all public information. People can look it up.
Saddam Hussein was a CIA hitman.
Exactly. When the Ba'athists came to power, what they did is their base was in the Sunni population. So the first people they persecuted were communists, then they went after the Shia, and they established a very harsh, it was secular but it was Sunni-centric rule. They disempowered the Shia. And the United States, we accepted that. We worked with it, and, you know, we really didn't care. And in fact, actually, when the Ayatollah took over in Iran, we liked the fact that they were anti-Shia because it meant it would keep Iranian influence out. Now, fast forward to the Iraq War, we decided suddenly to flip sides. We wanted de-Ba'athification, which was lunatic. I mean, it was worked off the idea of denazification. But we forget, though, that during denazification, Marshall left in place most of the Nazi judges, most of the Nazi police, many of the Nazi intelligence officers, all the guys who worked for the Department of Light and Power in Berlin, you know. We left these people in power because they knew how to keep the country running.
It's logistical. You can't just flip over an entire government.
Which is what we did in Iraq. We immediately disempowered the Sunni and we empowered the Shia. Well, then the Shia were getting too powerful. So then this civil war started, and both sides in that civil war, we had either armed or helped to arm. And it was during the massive bloodletting in 2006 when the Sunnis and the Shia were killing each other. And that worked out just great because as long as they were killing each other, it meant they weren't killing Americans. Fast forward even further, this builds up a tremendous amount of resentment between Sunnis and Shia. Now, the Sunnis and the Shia had seemed to reach a detente when suddenly all of these militant Wahhabis who we'd been sponsoring in Syria are now getting thrashed badly by Assad and his Russian allies, because let's not forget there are about 50,000 Russian troops in Syria. The Russians and the Syrians thrash these Wahhabis, so where do they flee to? Iraq, where there's already an element of resentment, plus they're largely being policed by Shia elements that don't really want to be there. The Wahhabis sweep in. They have all the guns, first of all. And you have some who are militantly anti-Shia, such as former Ba'athists and whatnot, who back these Wahhabi elements. Islamic Army of Iraq, which was actually Iraq and Syria, which was actually born in Iraq, they support the Wahhabis that are coming in. The average Iraqi doesn't like them, but these guys have all the guns. So they're coming to into Iraq from Syria with a massive amount of American arms. And so naturally, they're going to be the ones to hold political power. The other thing, though, is they also have the Ba'athist administration. So this really has empowered them in their takeover of Iraq, which really has played very well for the United States, in it has kept Iraq divided.
So are the Ba'athists making a comeback? Are the Ba'athists making a comeback in Iraq? Despite the fact that Wahhabis have the guns, the Ba'athists are kind of using them as a way to get rid of the Shia leadership?
I say it's a symbiotic relationship because they desperately need each other, because the Wahhabis need the Ba'athist administration. The Ba'athists were administrators. They ran the country. The Wahhabis don't know how to run the country the way the Ba'athists do. So they need the Ba'athists, because if you can't turn back on the electricity, the population's going to revolt against you. On the other hand, though, the Ba'athists aren't necessarily comfortable with the Wahhabi ideology, because as you mentioned, the Ba'athists are by and large secularists. They don't mind Christians. They tolerate Christians. They just don't like Persians and the Shia or Jews. On the other hand, though, the Ba'athists lack the guns and the money of the Wahhabis. So it's a symbiotic relationship. They desperately need each other. Both have one thing in common. Both are Sunnis and both don't like the Shia. That's really what binds them together.
If you just tuned in the show, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut. We're on air the fourth Monday of every month from noon to 1 p.m. And we talk about developments in the global wars, try to interpret their historical meaning, that put them in context so that you can understand them, and try to see how they affect U.S. national security. And we're speaking with Marshawn McDermott Rowe, In Context Military Affairs commentator. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm their host, and also with us is Gus Cantavero, our producer. Marshawn, we've been talking about the important role that Islam plays in the global wars, the role that Islam plays with respect to U.S. intervention in Muslim countries, but also how it plays a role in the fighting within Muslim countries, the sectarian violence, and particularly between the Shia and the Sunnis. And we've talked about the special role that the Wahhabis have played during these fights. Now, let's talk about the future of the Muslim world. In your view, Marshawn, is it going to go, which direction is it going to go into? Are the states, the Muslim nation states, liable to be fragmented into small entities in accordance perhaps with the long-term Oded and Yun plan, which goes back to the 1980s in Israel, which called for the breakup of these countries so that they really would be non-sustainable entities which would be easily ruled by outsiders? Or do you see it moving in the opposite direction, where one power is going to rise and, say, perhaps create a new caliphate, uniting the region the way the Ottoman Empire united the region up until the end of World War I? What do you think is the future as far as the Islamic nations go? And what do you see as its relationship to Israel and the United States?
Well, I mean, I think it's always very hard to predict. I mean, I think personally that you're very likely to see the rise of a new caliphate. I mean, Muslim unity is eventually inevitable. Periods of civil war are very common, but because of the collective individual weakness, I should say, of these countries, collective strength is the only way they're going to be able to protect themselves. And because unity is such a driving force, both for Sunnis and Shia, I think it's almost inevitable. I personally am inclined to think it's going to rally around Iran, because whether Sunni or Shia, people will prefer to have their television set and their computer rather than live in the Middle Ages under a Wahhabi caliphate, which really has, as it turns out, has become the only actual alternative in the Middle East. In terms of their relationship to Israel and the United States, I think, at least for the time being, it's going to be a very hostile one. I mean, Islam itself is not inherently hostile towards Judaism or towards secular countries like the United States. However, if we continue to stick our noses into the Middle East in a very hostile way, instead of trying to be a constructive force, leave chaos wherever we go, like instead of building a self-sustaining Iraqi democracy, we simply walk out and the country devolves into civil war, that builds a lot of resentment. And then, of course, our failure to help mediate a really viable peace deal between Israel and Palestine is also going to build up a lot of resentment. So I think at least in the immediate future, there is going to be a lot of hostility between the Middle Eastern countries and Israel and the United States. And I denote also the Middle Eastern countries, because let's not forget only 12% of the Muslim world is actually Arab. The rest are made up of Bosnians, Albanians, Turks, Indonesians, Malaysians, who are not
Africans
in that same vein. Africans too, you know, Nigerians, Somalis, who are not hostile, Ghanans too, who are not hostile towards the United States, because we haven't been, well, with the exception of Somalia, meddling in their internal affairs in a deconstructive fashion.
Yeah, we're working on it.
Yeah, as you can see in Nigeria, we are starting to work on it, and in Mali. But at least though, for the time being, if we really play a more constructive role in the Muslim world, you will see their relationship with the United States build. Whereas on the other hand, if we continue to be a destabilizing factor, if we continue to destabilize countries like Libya, then wash our hands of it and say it's not our problem, you know, that is going to build a lot of resentment.
Well, that just shows the destructive nature of this neocon policy of destabilizing a nation in order to take advantage of the vacuum of power. Instead of trying to export a libertarian society that tries to hold the value of individual rights above commercial interests, because that's really what this is about. It's about consolidating power and trying to make a fortune for the power players at the top. It's not about individual rights, because if it was, we never would have gone in to try to cut down Saddam Hussein with a military strike. You know, instead, it would just be to try to boost up economic relations and foreign trade.
Exactly. And really, at the end of the day, you know, whether these countries decide they want to have an Islamic republic like Iran, or whether they want a secular state like in Bosnia-Herzegovina, really our main concern should be, is this a country that we can do business with? Is this a country that's hostile to the United States? And is this a country that's committing genocide? Should really be our top priorities. Is this a country where we really want to show, hey, that we have a relationship with this country because, you know, we hold the same values, or do we, you know,
right,
want to betray everything we presumably stand for by backing despots and tyrants?
Right, like Saudi Arabia.
Like Saudi Arabia or the rebels in Syria.
Well, Marshawn, thank you very much. That's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month, on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. This program will be archived at WPKN.org and on our show's website, incontextreport.com. And you can watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and write to us at ken@mdrtalk.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott Rowe, producer Gus Cadavero, this is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
See ya.
See ya.